Okay, so I'm going to talk about quivers for metrics, and this is a work which has been done with Sergio Benvenuti. He's from Italy, from Pisa. Sebastian Franco is my student, graduating this year, and James Sparks is a postdoctoral fellow in Harvard, and Dario Martelli is a postdoctoral fellow in CERN. what we are going to see is about some exact results which we find for a system of metrics. We will see soon explicit expressions for metrics for which gauge theories dwell to them in a holographic fashion will be presented, and again the whole data about the gauge theory will be given. And so to begin with, when we are dealing with the deep brain probe, and what you can get with the deep brain probe, and when we say deep brain probe, we mean we take let's say type 2B string theory, we put four of the space dimensions to be flat, Minkowski, and six other dimensions to be Calabi-Yau manifold, and we are going to take this Calabi-Yau manifold to be non-compact, and we will put three brains sitting at the point on the Calabi-Yau and spanning the 3 plus 1 directions, flat directions. And if we vary the Calabi-Yau, if we vary the type of the singularity, we get different gauge theories. And so if you are doing field theory, it's interesting to study what type of gauge theories do you get as a function of the singularity. What happens when you vary the singularity, and how does the deep brain gauge theory react? So we put those deep brains at the tip of the singular manifold, and as I said before, the nature of the singularity determines supersymmetry, determines how many gauge fields do we have, how many matter fields, and what are their interactions. And if we are dealing with a singular Calabi-Yau, which is what we will do today, the supersymmetry will have four supercharges in 3 plus 1 dimensions, which is n equals 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. Okay? Now, in the ADS CFT, when we put a three brain on a singular Calabi-Yau, and let's say we call it X6, the holographic dual to that would be an ADS 5 times Y5, where if X6 is Calabi-Yau, is a Calabi-Yau manifold, then Y5 becomes a manifold which is called Sasaki-Einstein. Okay? Y5 is compact, and the form of the metric, how they relate to each other between the 5 manifold and the 6 manifold, is through this simple dependence of radial direction. R here gives the only non-compact dependence, or the only non-compact coordinate for the Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay? So our goal is to vary this X6. As a result, Y5 will be different, and we want to study what will be the corresponding gauge theory. So let's review what is known so far. The simplest example is the case in which Y5 is just the 5 sphere. That's the most symmetric case. I'll talk about this comment here later. In this case, the metric is just the five sphere metric, which you can get from writing down the metric in flat space. And the gauge theory, we will see a figure in the next slide, but the next gauge theory is n equals 4 gauge theory in four dimensions. Now, so let me emphasize, the metric is known, the metric is very simple, and the gauge theory is known. Okay? Both sides are known. Second example in which both sides are known is the so-called manifold T11. Metric is slightly more complicated than the five sphere metric, but not so bad. It's a vibration of a circle over two spheres, and a lot of work has been done over there. And there is a class of recently very new metrics, Y5 given YPQ. PQ are integers, and if we fix P, Q runs strictly above zero and below P. And these class of metrics were found by these people, and you see that this work goes back to about a year ago. Okay, so until then, very little was known about metrics, explicit metrics of Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. So these guys came and computed an explicit metric, which we will see soon. And once you had this metric, there was a very natural question in which, what is the corresponding gauge theory dual to that? Yes?
So this is not TPQ
spaces,
right?
No.
The metrics
for TPQ are also known. Right. So for TPQ, it's not supersymmetric. The gauge theory itself is not really understood, right? So the exercise that we are doing over here is to get examples in which explicit metrics are explicit information is not on both sides, right?
So basically, you look at the Einstein-Sasaki manifold, which has supersymmetry.
Right. Yes. Well, that gives the Calabi-Yau condition. So if it was TPQ, it wouldn't be a Calabi-Yau. Okay. Now, in terms of those P and Q, we can now go back and say that if you formally set P equals Q equals to 1/2, you reproduce the S5 case. And if you, I'm saying formally here because in the next transparency you'll see a metric and it will be singular. So it's a singular metric. But if you set it to 1 and 0, then it will be a nice metric, smooth, and it will be T11. So T11, if you want, is the simplest metric, the simplest example out of this family of solutions. Okay? Now, let's see what are the quivers for those metrics. We mentioned the S5. Here's the interaction superpotential. This is the quiver. It has one gauge group, and it has three adjoint fields. And the fields are denoted X1, X2, and X3. And the way they interact is through this simple interaction, a cubic interaction. And many, many works have been done on this one. So let's go to this quiver, T11. This is the quiver, two gauge groups now. The multiplicity of arrows is two. Two arrows are going over here, two arrows going backwards. For those of you who don't know what the quivers are, each node represents a gauge group, and each arrow corresponds to a field that transforms under, let's say, fundamental representation if it's an outgoing arrow, and anti-fundamental representation if it's an incoming arrow. Okay? And the superpotential is given here. The I, J, K indices run over 1 and 2. And 1 and 2, we can call, let's say, this one X1. This is X2. And you have a quartic superpotential. Okay? Good. So these are the cases in which two sides were known, gauge theory and metric. Let's look at the geometries now. Here's the geometry. And let's look at it a little bit. Let me present all of the formulas. Okay. So we have five coordinates over here, theta, phi. This one over here is just a round two sphere. Here's those two coordinates over here, psi and theta. They represent squashed two-sphere. There's no isometry as for the nice two-sphere over here. And then we can think of this five manifold as two circles, two spheres, and over which there is a vibration of a circle. And actually, this circle doesn't have to close on itself. It can, when it goes one circle, it doesn't have to close. It can actually ergodically feel the base as it is, as it goes around. And it is represented by the coordinate alpha. And you see a collection of parameters. Here are three functions. Those are cubic functions over here. And the parameter b determines those functions. It is given in terms of the following square root over here, square root over here, and this square root will appear all along this talk. It's a special square root. You note that if this square root is an integer. So if 4p squared minus 3q squared is an integer, then b becomes a rational number. And then that's the condition in which the orbit of the circle of the vibration to close. It closes after enough times. But if this number is not an integer squared, then the orbit just fills ergodically the base. Y1 and Y2 are the two boundaries of the Y coordinate, which is just an interval, and they satisfy, they are roots of a certain cubic equation. We don't have this cubic equation, but their explicit form is here. Okay, any questions about the metric? No. So, we will mention now special cases in which it is singular, but for general case, they are not. At y equals 1, y equals 1 is not special. There are two coordinates, y1 and y2. Why is this stuck? It doesn't go. Stopped. Okay. Oh, right. So y equals one is not a special case, but the parameter b, if it satisfies this condition, then the manifold is smooth. Right. So you see that b doesn't enter explicitly over here, but it enters into those three equations, okay? And it is this complicated function, okay? And it has boundaries between 0 and 1. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you reach one, the value one, yeah. Okay. So if you apply this condition that b is between 0 and 1, then you find that the parameters p and q that we had before satisfy this condition, where if q is equal to 0, for any p, b is equal to 1. And then the manifold is just an orbifold, a ZP orbifold of the first Y10 space or T11. Okay? And there is a very explicit action of the orbifold on the coordinates. If Q is equal to P, then B is equal to 0, and XPP, where now XPP I refer to the cone over YPP, is equal to C3 mod Z2P. This is an orbifold, where the action of the orbifold is the simplest action, which has n equals 1 supersymmetry. Yes? No, you act on. Yeah, so actually, do I have a formula? So if you describe the conic fold as xy equals yz, complex coordinates in four complex space, then the action is to act on x by a root of unity and on y by the inverse of that, and same thing on the other two coordinates. I see.
Because that's the action that you said is just the U1 action on the
fiber. Right, yeah, it acts on the charges only.
Yeah, so that's cool. So it might be just, you know, you shrink the fiber.
So. Okay, good. Okay, if P and Q are co-prime, then the following manifold, where you multiply P by N and Q by N, would be just the Zn orbifold of YPQ. So we get a rich set of manifolds, and actually this condition tells you that in some sense you can just consider P and Q to be coprime, and if they are not coprime, then you just look at orbifolds of these manifolds. Now, in terms of the quiver gauge theory, the dual gauge theory, what it means is that after Zn projection or any orbifold projection, some properties are preserved. For example, the R charge remains the same. And so we will see expressions soon that will show us that R charges are independent of this value of n. Another aspect of those manifolds, this is the third homology. There is an infinite part, Z, and then there is some torsion piece. We won't discuss the torsion piece, but it will be it's related to these orbifolds over here. We will be mostly interested in the discrete infinity part. And this thing over here tells us that there is a corresponding gauge field in the dual ADS geometry. And how does this guy comes about? The fact that H3 is equal to Z means that there is a homologically non-trivial free sphere. And when we consider a compactification of type 2B on an ADS times Y5. The four form wrapped on the free cycle gives rise to a gauge field, and this gauge field gives rise to conserved current in the gauge theory. So this gauge field will now be called U1, and B here stands for baryon number, because for the corresponding gauge theory, those objects will carry a non-zero baryon number.
But this free cycle will be contactable in the collider
yard
because it's a cone.
No, this is actually, in most cases, that's right, yeah. Except for YP0. Right, YP0, you will have still a non-contractible free cycle.
Okay.
But you're right, for any Q, it will not exist. Isometries. So if P and Q are odd, the isometry is this. I didn't show that, but we saw the SU. There was a two-sphere part over there, and there were two coordinates in which there was no dependence on, no explicit dependence on them. Therefore, there are two U1 symmetries. And if P and Q are not odd, then the symmetry is just the double cover of that. Why do we care about those isometries? Because the isometry becomes a global symmetry for the quiver gauge theory. Okay? So we expect to find now an SU2 global symmetry for the quiver, another U1, which will be a flavor symmetry, and the last U1 will correspond to an R symmetry, because this is a supersymmetric theory with n equals 1 supersymmetry, and therefore there is U1 R symmetry. Okay? So by now we have three U1s. Okay? We have U1F coming from the isometry. U1R is the isometry of the fiber of the 5 manifold. And U1B comes from the 4 form. It doesn't come from the geometry. It's a 4 form symmetry. Okay. Now, since you have explicit matrix, one of the simplest things to do is to compute the volume. And here's the volume. Okay, so one property is that if we fix P, it becomes monotonic in Q. These are the relations. So if you're thinking about the normalization group flows, then you would start from this theory and go this way along the normalization group flow. Here's the expression. You see that it's a function of this 4p squared minus 3q squared. In general, it's a complicated function. What I can say is that if p equals q equals 1/2, you will recover just pi cubed, which is the volume of the 5-sphere. Okay. Supersymmetric free cycles. There are two of them. Given by length spaces of index p plus q and index p minus q. And the reason we are interested in those supersymmetric cycles is that we can associate their volumes with R charges of the corresponding quiver gauge theory. And you see that there is a normalization of the total volume of the space, but if you take all of this combination here, you'll get an expression which makes sense in the corresponding gauge theory. Okay? And again, since we know explicitly the metric, this volume here can be given very explicitly, and here are the expressions. These are things that we have computed from the metric, and now we expect to find them from a corresponding dual gauge theory. Okay? Any questions so far? I think I've said all what I can say about the metrics, or all what we would need. Yeah. The condition for P and Q to be integer is in the construction of the metric. If they are not, then it's the equation that you write down cannot be solved. So, you know, they might be not integer, but then you'll have to worry about a different family of solutions. Might be, I don't know. Any other? Yeah?
I just have to ask a super dumb question. Usually when you orbital something, you have some fixed points and fixed planes, and you have to worry about the planes there. Do these have any, and if so, can we put over
So, strictly speaking, if you want to No, it's smooth for cases in which you don't have orbifold. So, if you want to take the smooth case, then you want to take the PQ coprime situation. Why P0 is interesting, as you will see soon, from the point of view of the quiver gauge theory, it's very interesting, but the manifold itself is not, at least you'll have to work more in order to show that it is smooth. For those of you who want to see the toric diagram, so each of these Calabi-Yau manifolds that you get by taking the cone over the five manifold has a toric description, and it's a very simple toric description. It consists of P plus one points which go along one line. There is one fixed point over here, and there is one point that moves as you vary Q. So Q equals zero is up here, and Q equals P is down here. Okay, it's always four external points, and P minus one internal points. Okay, so if you are familiar with toric geometry, that may tell you some information. We're not going to go too much over that. But I should say that this toric data allowed us to compute the quiver gauge theories that we are going to see shortly. Okay, so this was an essential point in the computation of the quiver gauge theories. Okay, quiver theories. So various properties before we present them. So one thing is that they have two P gauge groups for a given P and Q. The number of fields is 4P plus 2Q, and those are properties that you can extract just by looking at the toric diagram that we saw before. Okay. And there is some condition that we call the toric condition, which says that each bifundamental appears precisely twice in the superpotential, once with a plus sign and once with a minus sign. This condition by itself restricts the way you construct the gauge theory. Okay, so if you want to construct a gauge theory, there are all of these constraints that you need to take into account, and the set of constraints that we will see will actually determine the quiver gauge theory in a unique fashion. We talked about the isometry SU2 cross U1F and the baryonic symmetry, which comes from the four form, and all those guys now become the global symmetry. And so every bifundamental field, every state has to come in representations of those theories, and the superpotential has to be invariant under all of those three. Yeah? It's another symmetry. It is also a global symmetry, but it's a symmetry which acts differently on fermions and bosons, and therefore I do not include it over here. When we say global symmetry, that's a name that we use for a symmetry that acts the same on both fermions and bosons. Okay, but the U1R is definitely there. Okay. Okay, and what's the structure of the superpotential? We have two Q triangles, and when I say triangle, it's a product of three fields, of three bifundamental fields together in a gauge invariant fashion. And when I say rectangle, it's a product of four of them. Okay, in terms of the quiver, it will be very nicely given as a closed polygon, which it can be either a triangle or a rectangle. Okay, we have P minus Q rectangles, 2Q triangles. Okay, now one condition that we can already count from this is that we can multiply the number of times that the fields appear all together. 2Q triangles gives us 6Q, P minus Q rectangles give us 4P minus 4Q. We add all of these guys together, we find this condition, 4P plus 2Q by fundamental fields, And then you would ask me, okay, what about this factor 2 over here? And this factor 2 is coming from the fact that when we will write triangles and rectangles, they will always come with SU2 quantum numbers, and they will appear as two terms. So each triangle here is a two triangles and two rectangles. Any questions? Okay, so let's describe the orbifold theory. This is a simple theory. It can be determined using perturbative methods. Here's the example for Y44. And you see that there are 8 gauge groups. Is there a problem? 8 gauge groups. And you see that there are doublets over here, doublets of SU2, and singlets. Each node has 3 incoming arrows and 3 outgoing arrows. And that's a very typical feature of orbifold theories. And the superpotential consists of triangles. So here's a triangle. Okay. And it has one doublet here, one doublet here. They have to be contracted with an epsilon symbol in order to construct a singlet, right? Because we want to preserve the SU2 global symmetry. So we have this triangle. And altogether, remember, there are 2 Q triangles. Q is equal to 4. Therefore, 8 triangles consists the superpotential. Okay? Any questions? Good in what sense? Oh, well, the way it is constructed is by using the orbifold action, and the orbifold action tells you that the triangles which are close to the boundary would be the triangles to enter in the superpotential. So if you find things like, well, over here, I think that's the unique one. Right, so if you take P sufficiently large, then the triangles will just be at the boundaries. You see here that those blue arrows, the diagonal arrows, jump by 2. Okay, they always jump by 2. And the doublets, on the other hand, always jump by 1. So the triangle is simply a jump by 1, and back by 2. That's the way it is structured. And this is precisely the way the orbifold group acts. Okay, so you can think this quiver actually can be considered as a representation of the Z2P discrete group, where you consider each point as an irreducible representation of Z8 in this particular case, and each arrow corresponds to the way the groups decompose after multiplication by the basic representation. Any question? So here's the Z2 action I was talking about. Root of unity and inverse of that squared. These two correspond to the doublets, one doublet, and then this guy corresponds to the diagonal arrow. Okay? SU2 symmetry, global symmetry, isometry of the manifold, was what I said before. In terms of fields, this is what we get. We sum over all nodes of the quiver, and we get a cubic superpotential, the first doublet, the second doublet, and the diagonal field. Okay? With an epsilon contraction. Good. Any questions? Yeah, they are not chiral. Not chiral? I'm sorry, chiral. Yeah, chiral means that, in terms of the quiver, chiral means that for a given arrow, there is no identical arrow which goes back. And here...
Given one is not chiral, right? So the gate here
is... Very good. Okay, so... Most of them are chiral.
Okay.
Let's consider the generation which, well, actually we didn't see it yet, right? P11 is 10, and up to now we only saw PP, okay? But consider 11. 11 will consist only of 2 points. It will have two doublets. One which goes like that, and this one will just go backwards, so it will be non-chiral, and this diagonal will become an adjoint. So the 1-1 case is non-chiral, but most of them, as you see, they have polarizations, they have directions for arrows, and therefore they are chiral. Very good. That's right. Yeah, so for orbifold, this is a simple exercise. It's just the anomaly cancellation descends from the n equals 4 theory. For the more complicated orbifolds, that's not trivial, and we have to check that. Do they have? Vector structure in what sense? What do you mean by vector structure? I don't know if for all before you have such degree of freedom. The action, if there is a vector structure for the orbifold, as far as I know, I don't know how to make sense of that. I'm not sure. Discrete torsion? Oh, this doesn't have, this group doesn't have discrete torsion. Okay, so we can try and make and see what's the question really. Okay. we went over these guys. Now let's construct the other quivers, the quivers which are non-trivial. And I call this the impurity, and the impurity will consist of 3 steps. Okay? The first step is to pick an edge and remove an arrow. Maybe I'll say it in words and then we will look at it again. Where is this? Right. You pick an edge, this one. You remove one arrow. That's the first step. Second step is you remove 2 diagonals, which are the 2 ends of this edge. Together with these 2 diagonals, you remove from the superpotential the corresponding triangles. Okay? And the third step is to add a 4th arrow, like that, and a corresponding quartic term. Okay, so let's see this in words, what we said before. First step, pick an edge, remove an arrow. Second, remove 2 diagonals connected to the edges of this edge state, arrow. And you remove the 2 triangle terms in the superpotential. And the third step is to add a diagonal to form a rectangle, which is added to the superpotential. So at each step, each such impurity, what you do is to remove 2 triangles. And to gain one rectangle. Okay? It gives you a quiver, and let's see how it goes. So notice this. Notice what happens over here. Okay? The green objects become one arrow over here, becomes a singlet, and you replace 2 triangles by a rectangle. Okay? Note also that there is a doublet over here and another doublet over here, and therefore you can contract both of them into a singlet of SU2. Okay? This is Y43. How do we construct Y42? We repeat this three-step procedure again. So let's pick an edge here, over here, and let's remove the two diagonals and add a rectangle. Here's Y42. Okay? And we can do that on this place over here, Y41, and the last one, Y40. Okay? So now we understand how to construct all YPQ quiver theories. Okay? Good. How many different fields do we have? We have diagonal fields, and I would claim that all of them have the same R charge. Here it's just, you can argue they are the same just by symmetry, but in general for any Q where there is no symmetry, look at here, there's no obvious symmetry between all of them, but they turn out to have the same R charges by anomaly cancellation. There are doublet fields, which are these guys, but there are also green ones, okay? And they are different, they carry different R charges. And then there are singlets, those singlets that we introduced at the edges. So four types of fields. It's not that simple. I don't know how to describe it in a continuous fashion by introducing an operator and then integrating out. And the reason I cannot do that is because of the chirality. Oh. It's hard to introduce chiral.
It's complicated because the quotic potential is easier
understandable. Yeah. But there is a potential ambiguity. Let's talk about the ambiguity. Let's look at Y42. Y42, let's say that I removed an ambiguity, I put an impurity over here, but I could have put the other impurity down here, right? So I could have this quiver or this quiver. Oops. This or this. Both of them correspond to two actions of the impurity. So which one is the right one? So we would say, there are two quivers. They are different. They carry different quantum numbers. But do they correspond to the same manifold? And the answer is yes, they do correspond to each other through Seiberg duality, or more precisely through toric duality. If you would dualize over one of these nodes, what will happen is that this impurity will move one step. So it will move from here to here. Okay? So that's one lesson which is well known, but maybe for some of you it's not known. In general, for a given metric, you can have many quiver gauge theories, and in fact it can be infinitely many. Yeah.
So what you talk about metrics which are just cones, mm-hmm. that corresponds to conformal field theory. So what cyber duality, I need some RG flow in order to
do. Very good.
Here you don't have any RG flow.
Okay,
here,
so
this is the metric you're writing into the fixed point conformal.
Well, okay, so let's discuss that. So the quiver gauge theories that we write down are defined in the ultraviolet, and all of the fields over here, all of the bifundamental fields, start with R charge, which is equal to 2/3, or with anomalous dimension, which is equal to 0. Okay? At the UV, it's a free theory, and all anomalous dimensions are 0. As you flow to the infrared, there are interactions, anomalous dimensions are turned on, and all of those fields receive non-trivial anomalous dimensions, or we like to describe them in terms of R charges, non-trivial R charges. Okay? Now, Seiberg duality is a statement about the infrared limit of those theories. And when we talk about ADS-CFT correspondence, we should think of two sides. There is the side in which we deal with free brains and the Calabi-R. This is the UV. And there is the near horizon limit in which you deal with ADS-5 times the Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and that's the infrared. Okay? So on the infrared, no free brains anymore, no gauge degrees of freedom. All of the gauge quantum numbers will be gone, will not be there. Instead, we will deal with gauge invariant fields, gauge invariant operators, and all of this rich structure that you see over here will not be there. Okay? Now, how is this consistent with Seiberg duality? Seiberg duality is an equivalence of an infrared theory. Therefore, you can have two different UV theories, two different quivers, okay? Two different quivers, which in the infrared will be the same conformal field theory, the same ADS-5 and the same Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Okay? Any questions about that? Seiberg duality. Just apply Seiberg duality. There is a very simple rule. Actually, I have a figure for that. We will do Seiberg duality and we see how the impurity moves along the polygon. And you can actually be amused by taking the large field limit. Then this polygon will look like a circle. And you can think of Seiberg duality as just the motion of impurities along the circle.
But again, we don't see this in a metric because what we see in a metric is the way you present it, is just the infrared.
Right, yes.
So you see all just y for 2, which is the same for all three.
Yeah, what you see in the metric is something totally different, right? You see volumes, right? Volume of the 5 manifold, you see the volume of the 3 manifold. Nothing there is related to the gauge theory, and that's the duality. Not the metric. You can write down the, well, because it's a, this is an n equals 1 theory, and you cannot know the Kähler potential. You can compute the F-term conditions and write down algebraic variety, but doesn't produce the metric, right? You can write down an algebraic variety. It's doable. It hasn't been done to great detail, but it's doable. Been done, you can do it for simple examples. Yeah, you start with a UV, it's a trivial theory, it's a free theory. Every free theory is a conformal theory, and then you flow to the infrared to another conformal field theory, which is now is non trivial. No. Just the presence of the quartic potential implies that it is not conformal, and actually it's ill-defined as a quantum field theory because it's a quartic interaction, and a renormalizable theory at the UV allows only for a cubic and below. And actually I have, it's a good comment, I will show renormalizable gauge theories which have only cubic interactions, which start in the UV as well-defined, honest gauge theories, no quartic interactions, and they flow in the infrared to non-trivial conformal field theories with R charges that had this rich structure that you saw with the square root and so on. Okay, so if you want, it's a toy model for studying conformal field theories which are well-defined from the very beginning. They are not effective theories. They are good UV theories that flow to non-trivial infrared fixed points. Okay. Toric duality. Okay, so let's do some sequence of dualities. starting with Y44, let's introduce two ambiguities, these two. Okay? Let's dualize on a gauge group number 5. F5 means cyber duality on node 5. This is the node. And what you do is, I'll go very quickly on the rules of how to dualize. You invert the arrows. All of the arrows have to be inverted. You see these arrows are inverted. The arrow here is also inverted, and this arrow is inverted. And you also add mesons. The mesons are these guys. And there should be some other guys, which I don't see. Maybe some of you see it quickly. You do this. Over here you find two fields which are of opposite directions. Whenever we see such a thing, we need to check whether they integrate out, and they do integrate out. Once you integrate them out, you get this theory. We'll now note that we have switched the node 4 and node 5. Okay? And the other nodes remain the same. And you got the other two impurity model. Okay? So this is the statement of toric duality. By one step of the toric duality, meaning dualizing on node 5, rearranging the nodes, you get an equivalence between those two theories. No. Right? The infrared theory is the same. Cyber duality is an equivalence of infrared theories. The infrared theory is the Sasaki-Einstein limit. Okay. Let's talk about the different fields that I mentioned before. The purple doublets, those guys, we have P of them, always. And for the example of Y42, we have four of them, as you can count. The green doublets, those doublets which we are removing each time we introduce an impurity, we have Q of them, and in this case, two. There are edge singlets. There are P minus Q of them. And here again, two, because it's 4 minus 2. And we have diagonal singlets, those blue diagonal arrows, P plus Q of them. Okay? And those are four different types of fields. In the corresponding geometry, each such field will correspond to a free cycle, which will have a volume. And the volume needs to match the R symmetry. Soon we will see that each of those guys have different R charge. So we need to find four different free cycles with four different volumes that match those different fields. Now remember, there were two length spaces, one S3 modded out by ZP minus Q, and one other guy, S3 modded out by ZP plus Q, and those free cycles would correspond to those two singlet fields. Any questions? Higgsing the manifolds. By the way, let me know how much time do I have. I can finish any time you want me to. Okay. If I give vacuum expectation value to the edge singlet, those red fields, so I give a vacuum expectation value over here, what it means is that I introduce a scale to that particular field. As a result, the two groups which are charged under it receive a mass, such that the diagonal combination still remains massless. And if we flow to a scale which is low enough compared to the scale of the vacuum expectation value, the massive gauge bosons disappear, and we are left only with the massless ones. In terms of the quiver gauge theory, it's a very simple effect. We just reduce the two nodes on top of each other. Okay? So imagine that you take those two nodes together. You take those two nodes together. What you'll get is Y33, just the Z6 orbifold. Maybe you can see that quickly. And you'll get the collection of six triangles. Okay? So that's a nice consistency check, giving vacuum expectation values for all of those red fields will just give you the VP plus Q orbifold theory. This requires that the central charge, in order to be consistent with the A theorem, which says that the number of degrees of freedom of the theory you started from and the number of degrees of freedom of the theory you ended up with should be bigger. And then in order to check such a thing, that A, the central charge, is bigger, what you just need to do is to compare the volumes. The volumes are inversely related to the central charge, and indeed, this condition is satisfied. I'll have a relation. Let me think. It's not known, actually. No. What it would mean in the geometry is an interpolation between an ABS5 times Y42 and ABS5 times Y33. Okay? Along the flow, you will lose the ABS property. It's not conformal anymore. And you'll need to have a continuous family of solutions from this space to this space. It's not known, very interesting to find. Sorry? Yeah. But it's probably too difficult, Christian, right? Too difficult to write down the general metric, the family of metric, which will describe the flow. There has been quite many attempts to compute flows like that in much more simpler examples. And the equations are too complicated to solve, as he can tell you. The intermediate steps are not well defined, so I won't discuss them. Maximization. Let's compute R charges. And let me review the central charge argument. The central charge is related to the other R charge by this relation. And there is a process introduced by Intelligator and Vecht, which said that if you want to compute the R charges of all of the fields, what you need to do is to express the central charge A in terms of the R charges and to maximize, to find a local maximum of this quantity. And at the local maximum, the explicit values of those fields will give you the right R charges of the conformal field theory. Okay? Here's an explicit relation between the central charge and the volume. And if we will be able to compute the central charge using the A maximization, we will compare this to the volume and see if we find agreement. So let me just go briefly over the computation. So there is a consideration here which says that you will have only two unknowns in the expression for the central charge. This is the equation. We won't go over this, but let's see the formulas. Remember we counted fields. And let's say we give the singlets, which are at the edges, R charge X, and those which are diagonals, R charge Y. Using anomaly cancellation conditions, the other doublets would have this outcharge, and then there will be the green ones with this outcharge. You collect all of those guys together into the expression for the central charge, and this is how it looks. You see that it looks like a cubic function of x and y. And what you want to do is to maximize this locally. Okay? Take the derivative with respect to x, with respect to y, equate to zero, and find the solution. And here are the solutions. And those are the solutions that we reproduce from the volumes many slides ago. Okay? So this is the crown of our finding. That's the nice result after introducing all of these things. Two totally different computations gave rise to the same, exactly the same quantity over here. And look at this complicated expression. We have infinitely number of manifolds for which we know explicit metrics, and we know how the gauge theory is defined, including the interaction terms and the gauge fields and matter fields. Okay? Here's the table which summarizes the R charges. Those are the four types of fields, the two singlets, the two doublets, those are the multiplicities, the R charges that they carry. Each one of them is a different free cycle. This is the length space ZP plus Q, the length space P minus Q, and two other three cycles. Those are baryon quantum numbers and flavor quantum numbers. Okay? We can talk about double impurities, but we can also skip that. That's an interesting point by itself. If you want, you can ask me about this. Let me conclude. Okay. We have infinite family of quiver gauge theories with Sasaki-Einstein duals. We can turn on fluxes. That's a transparency that I did not go over. But you can ask, you know, what can we do with such a thing? Okay, suppose that we got excited, we found the exact metrics, and we found the R charges. What can you do with that? So one simple application is to introduce fluxes to change the ranks of the gauge groups. The theory is no longer conformal, and then you have a renormalization group flow. And in the corresponding dual theory, you start having a metric which is varying with respect to the fluxes that you turn on. And you want to find the solutions, to find something which is similar to the Klebanov-Strassler solution. And study the new metrics that you find. Okay, there are a few phenomenological applications, like going down the throat. You can have more than one throat. Since it's a rich structure with two integers, you can study the properties as a function of those two integers. Very nice set of applications that you can think of. Here's another interesting comment for the field theorists here. I can say that this work gives rise to relatively simple gauge theories. The simplest one has four gauge groups and 10 fields, and it has a nice UV description and a non-trivial infrared theory. So as a field theorist, you can study what the properties of this conformal field theory, and all of the complaints that T11 is not a well-defined theory because it has a quartic interaction, those complaints can be avoided here because you start with cubic interactions only. It's a normalizable quantum field theory. Okay? So if you want, it is special in the sense that the anomalous dimensions at the infrared are known exactly, and they are non-rational. Right? They carry those square roots. There are other constructions that you can do. You can, for example, ask what happens if I dualize many times. If I apply cyborg duality, we have so many nodes, I can apply that on this node here and that node and after that many times. What happens after 100 cyborg dualities? What kind of structure do I get, and how does this imply on the geometry? Okay, so that's the kind of question that one can ask. These answers can be phrased in terms of certain Diophantine equations, which has not been found yet. So that's an interesting problem to think about. And I think that that's enough for today. Thank you.